Without seeing them, we distinctly heard the roar of the Russian rockets, which turned both banks of our ditch into ridges of broken earth. Our friends were sure we were dead. The planes made one more pass, and flew off, undoubtedly convinced that they had brought our wanderings to an end. When we walked out through the whirling dust, our companions greeted us with shouts of incredulous delight. At the farm, which the inhabitants had abandoned some 15 minutes before our arrival, we found a kettle full of steaming Jerusalem artichokes, which had undoubtedly been left to distract us. We went on our way, gorging on this unexpected windfall. 2 days later, during which we twice collected potatoes from Russians at gunpoint, we ran into an interminable convoy retreating into Romania, and were inescapably absorbed into it. Then we experienced Romania and its population, which seemed stunned by the sequence of events, by the route of their army, and by the painful disintegration of the Wehrmacht. Civilian life was in a state of panic, with Romanian and foreign partisans, daily overflights of foreign planes, raids for food and supplies, and Romanian prostitutes who flocked around the troops in such numbers that it seemed as if most of the women in Romania must be prostitutes. We marched 20, 25, even 30 miles a day, pouring with sweat and stunned by disillusion. Our tortured feet were alternately bare in the dust of narrow, twisting roads, then back in our boots, and then naked and bleeding once more. Our hollow stomachs rumbled with hunger. There were raiding parties, reformation of units, and a lunatic rabble, whose fringes and surface were skimmed by military police intent on discipline, and as always alert for the possibility of exemplary executions. The landscape was profoundly romantic, but we had been transformed into ravening wolves, and thought of nothing but food. A particular episode emerges from my memories of disorder, a tragic paroxysm which still seems to me a symbol of humanity gone mad. We were in the mountains and had just been through a town called Regin, which at the time was known as Arlo, or Erlo. We were tramping along, grey with dust and pouring with sweat. We had miraculously escaped incorporation into several scratch formations, and our interminable, wretched column was twisting through what seemed like an infinite chain of mountains. The column was broken up into groups of varying size, in which unkempt soldiers pushed along every kind of transport to move our basic necessities. We requisitioned the most extraordinary vehicles. Anyone who found a bicycle grabbed it, even if it had no tires, and went on ahead of the rest to skim off anything even remotely digestible. In this district of jagged peaks and crags, we were free of enemy aircraft, but the terrain was ideal for partisans, and there were many battles to the death between them and our men, who were now fighting simply to save their skins. In this district, one group among many others of men in a motley conglomeration of clothes was struggling to reach the mother country. Behind our glittering eyes, deeply sunk into shadowy sockets, one belief sustained us. This was that, if we managed to survive, the mother country would receive us with tenderness, and try to help us forget the unimaginable trial which was nearly over. We thought that, once we reached home, the war would be over, and that in the worst imaginable case the army would be reorganized, so that no enemy would enter Germany itself. We held to this as the one final idea which would justify our sufferings and banish the solution of suicide which others had already accepted. Yesterday's Lancer, members of elite units, Panzergrenadiers who had confronted 1,000 deaths to live for a chimera, clung to the idea that we had to live to be able to hope, and we had to hope passionately to be able to live as we were. We had to fight against daily ambush, and keep going no matter what, to get away from the Russians, who were hard on our heels. And we had to eat a certain minimum, which wasn't easy to do. There were 12 in our group, many of them familiar companions: Schlosser, Frosch, Lieutenant Wallers, Lenzen, Kellerman, and then Hals and me, kept together by a miracle of silent fraternity. Hals, who had grown startlingly thin, was forcing his large bony body along the narrow mountain road some 4 or 5 yards ahead of me. He often walked ahead of me, which gave me a certain sense of security, although his large body was seriously reduced. He was stripped to the waist, wearing a leather belt and a band of cartridges for the spandau across his chest. A Russian blouse, in anticipation of the cool evenings at this altitude, floated from the leather pouch that held his few possessions along with four or five grenades. His heavy steel helmet seemed to be riveted to his head, and the lice in his filthy hair must have died for lack of light. Many men had thrown away their heavy helmets, but Hals felt his was a last link with the German army, and that during this terrible trial we should try to remain soldiers, rather than degenerate into tramps. I kept mine too, as a sign of solidarity, dangling from my belt. Someone up ahead shouted for us to come and see. We looked down into a leafy ravine. A camouflage truck bearing the inscription WH had crashed to the bottom. Lenson was already running down to have a closer look. Watch out! Someone shouted. It might be a trap. Lieutenant Wallace had joined Lenson. We drew back, certain that the partisans had arranged a booby trap, and that we would see our two companions blown to pieces any minute. However, a reassuring shout floated up from the gulf. A windfall. Mein Gott, it's like a whole commissary. Within seconds we were all running toward the miracle. Look at that. Chocolate, cigarettes, worst. Good God. And here are three bottles, too. Shut up, shouted Schlosser, or you'll have the whole army down here. It's a miracle no one found this before. So many delicious things, said Frosch in an almost tender voice. Let's all grab everything we can. We can share it out later, on the road. Frosch and another fellow loaded themselves heavily, and climbed back to the road to keep watch. Thousands of men were wandering very close to us. We would try to take everything. We had almost completed the job when our two lookouts shouted, Achtung! We ran into the brush and heard the distant roar of a motorcycle. The engine slowed down and seemed to stop. We ran off through the thorny growth, clutching our precious cargoes. We were used to getting out of the way in a hurry and melting into the ground when an unfriendly eye might become too interested in our existence. We could hear some non-coms shouting, and supposed that our two companions had been caught by a military patrol, perhaps even by the military police. Those two sods were caught with bottles under their arms, muttered Wallace. Let's get out of here as fast as we can, said Lindbergh, who had just run up. Someone's coming down, whispered Lenson. An M.P. I saw his badge. Hell, let's get out of here. Everybody ran, scattering into the bushes as if Ivan himself were at his heels. We regrouped after 500 or 600 yards, hiding behind a rocky outcrop. I've lost enough breath because of those bastards, said Hals. If they want to chase us this far, I'll take care of them. You're crazy, said Lindbergh. Don't talk like that. What are you trying to do to us? Shut up. Hals said. You'll never make it home anyway. Ivan's going to get you for sure. Why don't you think for a minute of Frosch and the other fellow who've been caught? We might as well eat, said Wallace. I've had enough of giving orders, and sweating, and shitting in my pants like a baby when I'm scared. So let's get started. If we're going to die for it, all the more reason to fill our bellies while we can. Like hungry beasts, we wolfed down the contents of the tins and the other provisions, masticating loudly. We'd better eat it all, Lenson said. If we're caught with anything in our sacks that wasn't handed out, we'll be in trouble. You're right. Let's eat it all. They won't slit us open to see what's inside, although it would be just like those bastards to check our shit. For an hour we gorged ourselves until we were almost sick. When it grew dark, we returned to the road by a devious route. Lenson stepped out of the brush first. Come on, the coast is clear. We went on for 300 or 400 yards, passing once again the hole with its unexpected windfall which had allowed us to fill our famished stomachs for a moment. There was no one in sight. We went on for another 2 or 3 miles, and collapsed at the side of the road. I can't go any further, said Schlosser. We're not used to eating anymore, and this is what happens. Why don't we go to sleep right here? Someone said. That will help our digestions. Toward 2 o'clock in the morning, a large group of German soldiers came by and woke us up. "On your feet," shouted an old Feldwebel. "Get going, or Ivan will be in Berlin before you." We resumed our trek. This bunch had collected several horse-drawn wagons, and for a while, we were able to ride. At daybreak, we arrived at a town built on their mountainside. Some men were splashing in an icy bathing place. Others were sleeping on the ground or on terrace walls. Farther on, still others had begun their march again, toward safety, the West, the mother country, waiting to receive them, whose true condition they couldn't begin to guess. And then there was a tree, a majestic tree, whose branches seemed to be supporting the sky. Two sacks were dangling from those branches, two empty scarecrows swinging in the wind, suspended by two short lengths of rope. We walked under them, and saw the grey, bloodless faces of hanged men, and recognized our wretched friend Frosch and his companion. "Don't worry, Frosch," whispered Hals. "We ate it all." Lindbergh hid his face in his hands and wept. I managed with difficulty to read the message scribbled on the sign tied to Frosch's broken neck. "I am a thief and a traitor to my country." A short way off, some 10 policemen in regulation uniform were standing beside a sidecar and a Volkswagen. As we walked by them, our eyes met theirs. Part 5. The End, Autumn 1944 to Spring 1945, From Poland to East Prussia, the Volkssturm, the Invasion. One September morning, we found ourselves in a farmyard somewhere in the south of Poland. The horror of our previous experiences had left us entirely without reaction, and we stared about us with the stunned eyes of someone who has been heavily drugged. A short way off, an officer was shouting something at us, a speech or a report which fell on deaf ears. We stared at the sky, to avoid thinking about the earth, which supported human life. Only an explosion, or perhaps a Feld's whistle, could have dragged us from our lethargy. However, in this district there was at least a semblance of order, and under cover of this last fragment of organization we were trying, as best we could, to recover our strength and some sense of morale. The Russian thrust to the south was so strong that we had to consider Romania enemy territory. We should soon be fighting in Hungary too, before Kecskemét, and then in Budapest. The officer went on with his speech, to talk of a counter-offensive, of regaining control of events, regrouping our troops, even of victory, a word which no longer had any meaning for us. Although we couldn't conceive of the defeat which lay ahead, we understood that victory was not possible. We knew that we would still be obliged to make intense efforts defending some particular, organized positions. But we had no doubt that we could stop the enemy before the German frontier. Despite our general unease and near collapse and all our disillusion, we knew that we couldn't simply give up. The looming disaster was inconceivable to us. Even today, survivors of that experience find it difficult to accept all the facts. But, despite our unshakable faith, we all felt temporarily unable to continue fighting. Some time off, some rest, was absolutely essential. We were in a state of exhausted collapse, capable of nothing. "General Friesner has re-established the southern front," the officer was shouting. "Our regiments will be reformed and reinforced by substantial reserves. The enemy must not go any further. You will stop him." We were divided into groups, companies, and regiments, and loaded into trucks. It seemed there was still gas hereabouts. The Gross Deutschland units were sent north, which surprised us, as the rest of the division or what was left of it was fighting with Army Group Center. Some units were already with Army Group North, and the two hard-pressed armies were eventually joined. The trucks took us to a train which was waiting on a single track, sheltered by a pine forest. There was no station. We left in a long string of miscellaneous cars. My group was loaded onto an open platform like the one which had taken me out of Poland and into Russia so long ago. Today there was no need to fear any future in Russia. The Germans had been chased from that country. Today we were going north, slowly and carefully, as the track might be mined, or the sky full of bombs. The train took us to Lodz, where we saw many astonishing things. We stayed in Lodz for about 30 hours. The front was very close, and like all towns near the fighting, Lodz was full of troops. As in the south, men were being sorted out and regrouped. 30, 40, even 50% of the names on the regimental lists had to be scratched off. In some cases, men already scratched off as dead or missing reappeared from the void. The Gross Deutschland had a rallying point at Lodz, a former candy shop stripped of all its wares, the adjoining room for the concierge, and a long corridor, a large panel correctly painted black on white, and a stylized white helmet, the regimental emblem, hung over the door, which was still intact. Two sentries in correct uniform were stationed on either side of the door. "Here we are," Lenson said. "Back at the Gross Deutschland." For an hour and a half we had been tramping through the city from which nearly all the civilians had gone looking for this place. Lieutenant Wallace presented the officer at the center with his list of the men with him, including the numbers of their companies, regiments, and groups. There were about 200 of us. "Here is the list of men with me, Herr Hauptmann. But you're bringing me a bunch of Ruskies, Herr Lieutenant," the captain said, looking at our motley collection of clothes. Many of us were wearing padded Russian jackets. "My apologies, Herr Hauptmann. We began to run short of uniforms." "Very short," said the officer, smiling. "I'm going to send you to the store, and you'll see if there's anything left. You'll have to be quick, because you won't be here long." In the next street, we found the divisional store, which was still much better stocked than the supplely stores of ordinary divisions. Some of our men could be given quite a few of the things they needed. While we waited, we watched a crowd of men, part of a new Volkssturm battalion, swarm into a factory courtyard. When we looked more closely at these men recently called up by the Führer, our eyes opened wide with surprise. They all belonged to the last class of reserves and seemed to be an even more extreme case than the Maria Louise conscripts at the end of the Napoleonic era. Some of these troops with Mausers on their shoulders must have been at least 60 or 65, to judge by their curved spines, bowed legs, and abundant wrinkles. But the young boys were even more astonishing. For us, who had saved our 18, 19, and 20-year-old lives through 1,000 perils, the idea of youth meant childhood and not adolescence, which was still our phase of life, despite our disillusion. But now we were looking literally at children, marching beside these feeble old men. The oldest boys were about 16, but there were others who could not have been more than 13. They had been hastily dressed in worn uniforms cut for men, and were carrying guns which were often as big as they were. They looked both comic and horrifying, and their eyes were filled with unease, like the eyes of children at the reopening of school. Not one of them could have imagined the impossible ordeal which lay ahead. Some of them were laughing and rehearsing, forgetting the military discipline which was inassimilable at their age, and to which they had been exposed for barely 3 weeks. We noticed some heart-wringing details about these children, who were beginning the first act of their tragedy. Several of them were carrying school satchels their mothers had packed with extra food and clothes, instead of school books. A few of the boys were trading the saccharine candies which the ration allotted to children under 13. The old men marching beside these young sprouts stared at them with incomprehension. What would be done with these troops? Where were they expected to perform? There was no answer to these questions. Were the authorities going to try to stop the Red Army with them? The comparison seemed tragic and ludicrous. Would total war devour these children? Was Germany heroic, or insane? Who would ever be able to judge this absolute sacrifice? We stood in profound silence, watching and listening to the final moments of this first adolescence. There was nothing else we could do. Some hours later, we were driven to a new assembly area a few miles from the Vistula, in a town called Meadow. There we found a large part of our full division, which had left us in the south long ago. Even our regiment was there, and its officers, with their familiar names. The auxiliary services of our autonomous unit had performed enormous feats of imagination to continue functioning. We were extremely surprised to find that the full Gross Deutschland division was still quite strong, a discovery that raised our morale considerably. We needed to cling to some form of solidity to avoid recognition of the final tragedy which had engulfed us, and of our strictly limited choice between combat in the most desperate circumstances, captivity, or the end, once and for all. Here, on the banks of the Vistula, which could be considered the cradle of hostilities, we found companies restocked with young boys to fill the gaping holes the war had made in our elite division. We also found some familiar faces, including Wiener, the veteran, who seemed quite astonished that we were all still alive. "We must really be indestructible," he exclaimed. "When I left you on the second Dnieper front, everything looked so black I really thought I'd never see any of you again." "Quite a few missing," Wallace said. "And quite a few still here. Mein Gott, Lieutenant. We told Wiener that Wesredo was dead, and Frosch. He too had a list of names we could forget." No matter how intense the grief aroused by any particular name, the expressions on our worn faces never changed. We pressed Wiener for news of Germany, of civilian life there and the situation of ordinary citizens. We all had reasons for concern and followed the movements of his lips, trying to grasp the implications of his inadequate words. "I was in the Kansi military hospital in Poland," he told us. "I had lost so much blood and seemed so weak that for two horrible days they did almost nothing about me. I would never have guessed that life had so strong a grip on me. It would have been so easy, one last sigh, and then into the hole. But it didn't happen that way. I groaned and howled for 10 days or so, especially the first two, and went through infection, transfusion, disinfection, reinfection, and here I am, back with you again, for another autumn of crap. Now I find the damp hard to take, too. I've got rheumatism, and that's fatal." As before, the veteran relieved his desperation by cracking jokes. "But you must have had convalescent leave, didn't you?"
"Yes, Hals.
I was in Germany. I went to Frankfurt, not Am Main, but Am Oder. I could have gone further if I'd wanted to, but there wasn't any particular reason. They put us up in a girls' high school, sad to say, without the girls. There wasn't enough to eat, but at least they let us alone. Have you noticed, by the way, that I'm missing an ear?" The veteran grinned sardonically. When we looked, we saw that his right ear was gone, and that his skin where the ear should have been was a pale, shiny pink, which looked as though it might break at any minute. We had all noticed, without attaching any particular significance to it. So many men were missing one piece or another that we scarcely registered such things anymore.
"Yes," Prinz said. "On that side, you look dead."
The veteran grinned again. "That's because you're so used to stiffs you're beginning to see them even where there aren't any."
"Drop all the crap," Solmer shouted, "and tell us about Germany."
"Well. Yes." There was a moment of silence, which seemed to last forever. "What's it like in Frankfurt?" asked Feldwebel Sperlovsky, elbowing the rest of us aside. He came from Frankfurt, and his family was probably still there. The veteran was no longer looking at us. He seemed to be staring into his own interior. The high school was on the east banks of the Oder, up on a hill. You could see a big piece of the town from there. It was all grey, the colour of dead trees, with walls sticking up here and there, all black from the smoke of fires. People were living down there, like ants in the trenches. As Sperlovsky listened, his face began to twitch, and his voice trembled as he spoke. "But our fighters. And Flak. Wasn't there any defense?"
"Of course. But so out of proportion."
"Don't worry too much, Sperlovsky," Wallace said. "Your family was certainly evacuated to the country."
"No," Sperlovsky shouted in a voice of despair.
"My wife wrote me that she had been conscripted and had to stay in town. No one has the right to leave his job." Wiener knew very well what effect his words must have on an audience starved for good news, but nothing seemed to distress him anymore.
"It's total war," he said, "like an automaton. Nothing and no one will be spared, and German soldiers must be able to endure everything."
Sperlovsky walked away.
He looked stunned. His eyes were glazed, and his steps faltered, as if he were drunk. German soldiers would have to endure everything, in the world we had created. We were fitted only for that world, and were otherwise inadaptable. Lenson was as still as stone, and listened, stony-faced. Is it the same for all our towns? Lindberg asked. He must have been thinking of his town, by Lake Constance. I don't know, the veteran said. It's possible. You certainly know how to raise morale, said Hals in irritation. Do you want the truth, or a fairy story? I felt as though I were wandering through a landscape shrouded with fog and strewn with rubble. I knew that I could never manage to be disappointed again. Before morning with a suffering world, I would somehow have to regain my balance. Of course I thought of Paula, but it was so long since I had heard anything from her that I wondered if I would even be capable of reading a letter if we should suddenly get mail. I was filling up with bad news like a barrel filling with water from a rain pipe. When the barrel is full to overflowing, all the torrents in the world are incapable of adding to its capacity. We found ourselves in one of the rare trains still moving through that region, rolling toward East Prussia through the first frosts of our third winter of war, the fifth or sixth for some of the older men. We moved at night, with all our lights out, as Russian planes, which occupied our bases in Poland, were particularly active by day. We were moving toward Prussia, Lithuania, Latvia, and the Courland Front, to which the remnants of several German divisions were clinging. Through the darkness and the thick fog we could see large masses of people moving on foot across the northern Polish landscape. At first, we thought we were watching infantry units on the march. But after several good looks we realized we were watching civilians, thousands of them fleeing through the night and fog to escape the Red Hordes who they sensed were very close behind them. We couldn't linger to watch those people, but could easily imagine their situation. Then we crossed the Prussian frontier, into the home territory of Lenson and Smelen's two purebred Prussians, suddenly back on their native soil. Lenson stood up and leaned over the carriage door to get a closer look at his country. The rest of us didn't care so much. The landscape was scarcely distinguishable from that of Poland. Perhaps there were a few more lakes. Otherwise, as in Poland, there was forest. You really ought to see it when there's snow on the ground, Lenson said. He was suddenly smiling again. This way, you can't really tell what it's like. As we remained silent and uninterested, he spoke up again. You're in Germany, for the love of God. Wake up, think how long you've been dreaming of this. East Germany, Wiener said, practically the front. And then, I don't know if you realize it, but I have a compass, and I can tell you we're moving to the northeast, which is no good at all. Once again Lenson turned purple with anger. You're nothing but a bunch of milksops, he said. It's your kind of defeaters that's brought us to this. The war is already lost inside your goddamned heads. But you've got to fight anyway, whether you want to or not. Shut up! Shouted five or six voices. If they want us to win the war, let them treat us like normal soldiers. You're just a bunch of whining puppies. The whole time I've known you, you've done nothing but whine. For you. The war has been lost since Voronezh. For good reason, Hals said. You'll fight, whatever the cost. And I'm the one who's telling you because you have no choice. There's no other way out. The veteran stood up. Yes, Lenson, we'll fight because we can't stand the idea of defeat any better than you can. And we have no choice. I don't, anyway. I'm part of a machine which operates a certain way, and only that way, and I've been part of it for too long. We stared at Wiener, somewhat taken aback. We had thought he would be able to adapt himself to any kind of life. And now here he was saying that he could live only for the cause which had already cost him so much. Lenson went on grumbling, and we went on thinking confusedly about the glimpse of the future the veteran had given us. For me, from the vantage point of Prussia, France seemed remote and unimportant. The cause which Wiener spoke of was also my cause. And despite all the difficulties and disappointments I had endured, I still felt closely linked to it. I knew that the struggle was becoming more and more serious, and that we would soon be obliged to face appalling possibilities.